thank you for pointing out this date is incorrect. This will be September 19th. It's a Wednesday, so thanks for our Wednesday rule, cock the bud. So thank you. So Mark Bowick and I today were able to get these, so thank you, Mark, for getting the speakers to agree within 1 hour.
Lars?
Yes?
What on earth is quantum glass?
Mark, what is quantum glass?
Well, do you know what ordinary glass is?
Yes.
Okay, ordinary glass, you put down a liquid, and at low temperature it gets very, like, viscous and makes a glass. That's when you're changing the temperature. Quantum glass is a completely different mechanism of making something like a glass, but it's fluctuating quantum mechanically, not thermally. So, come to the talk, find out exactly.
Sounds like I won't understand it.
You will.
Okay, so that's the 19th. Then on November 28th, we'll have Louis Hoffman on knots in physics. So we have a program on sort of geometry of knots as applied to physics and some mathematical physics. And we decided to have this as a chalk talk because he does rope tricks. So is he better in this environment than a public lecture? Those of you who've experienced close-up magic, you've got to let him know that we have this high expectation.
Hey, nice. He's working on it.
He's working on it. So those are the two chalk talks that are coming up for the rest of the calendar year. We have an invitation out for a public lecture for sort of in the middle in October, but the speaker is yet to respond. Probably because I sent the email instead of Mark. And so we'll see how that plays out. But that would pretty much be the slate for the fall. Okay? So
thank you.
Yeah. So again, this is September 19th, November 28th. So mark your calendars. So we'll be sending out those. Okay, well, it's really my pleasure to introduce Jimmy. I, as all of you know, we use, shall we say, or take advantage of the visitors to KXP programs for these talks. And Jimmy came highly recommended, not just by Maggie, but by others, as someone who would really bring an exciting talk to us. And Jimmy did his undergraduate work at Wesleyan, then went to Harvard for his PhD, and then, of course, finally went to a real university, Cornell. Postdoc, and is presently at University of Florida, at an unusual operation that's off campus, but is right on the Atlantic Ocean. And with no further ado, Jimmy, I'm going to let you take it away.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me all right?
Yes.
Super. Yeah. Thank you, Lars, Maggie, for inviting me to give this talk today. It's really a deep privilege. I get to talk about something that's very near and dear to my heart, which is fish behavior. And so I'm here for 3 weeks teaching the QBio course. And it really is a wonderful situation where it's kind of like summer camp for scientists. And I get to interact with my colleagues in a way that I never really have before, just because usually we're so busy with conferences. We get to chat for 5 minutes in the hallway. Here we can like have dinner together. We can go for walks. And we can really get deep into our science. So thank you all for that opportunity. I want to talk to you today about a subject that I said really goes deep in my life, and it is fish behavior. And so the title of my talk is The Tao of Fish Swimming. Hopefully this will become a little more evident later on. What we're looking at right here is a rainbow trout, Oncorhynchus micus, that's swimming in a flow tank in my lab. It's a treadmill for fish. We're looking up at the motion. And we could probably spend the next 15 minutes just looking at this motion, because it's so soothing, right? Everyone has a fish tank that kind of looks at fish and kind of just zones out. But actually, there's a rich field of study on fish locomotion. And I'm very interested in kind of fish behavior, fish diversity. So there's actually, over 33,000 species of living fishes. Right? And those of you, how many of you snorkel or scuba dive? And so you know this rich diversity on coral reefs, right? And so these fishes make up half of all living vertebrates, that is, animals with a backbone such as ourselves. And not only are they morphologically very diverse, lots of different shapes, but behaviorally they're also very diverse. The history of fish swimming, in terms of scientific studies, is very rich. It goes way back, right? Aristotle studied fish motion, the movements of animals here. Borelli, who was a student of Galileo, also studied the motions of animals, including fish. E.J. Marais, who pioneered cinematography, gave us great insights into the motions of the body of fishes. And Charles Breeder, a prominent biologist, kind of classified different modes of locomotion based on the different types of fishes that were out there. And so if you look at a fish swimming, it's a beautiful thing, and it's actually, to describe it mathematically, is simply derivation of a sine wave, just a wave, a rope that's kind of being flapped, right? So formally, the equation is such that, you know, you can, given a certain point along the body and a certain time, you have this modified sine wave equation that takes into account the body wavelength of the fish, as you can see here in red, as well as a tailbeat frequency. So all these scientists before me that have studied it choose to study fish swimming in very simple hydrodynamic conditions. So what do I mean by that? They study fish swimming through still water, or they study it swimming through a very kind of a laminar stream. And they have to do this because it's potentially very complex. You have complex hydrodynamics, you have the physiology of the fish, the biomechanics of the fish. But I would argue that still water isn't the only situation where fishes have evolved from. How many of you in this room fly fish? All right, those are my people here. Okay, all right. Fly fish or any fish, really. But so me and fish, we kind of go way back. Starting out when I was a kid, growing up in New York City, fishing the East River, you know, with my parents. All the way out, I'll just point to a couple things. This is me in Maine with a striped bass. This is a barramundi in Australia. We've got a trout in Tasmania, the canals of Galway in Ireland, Bermuda when I taught a fish class there, Indonesia with a Jack Crevalle. My first permit on the fly, a tarpon on the fly, a big snook I caught a couple months ago, a big striper on the fly in the Cape, bonefish in Hawaii, piranha in the Amazon. So I've really kind of looked at fishing. It's very near and dear to my heart. But it's also something I try to study scientifically, and I think anglers are the first real neuroethologists, the first people that really look at animal behavior very carefully. I used to fish professional bass fishing tournaments. Here's me and the only picture of me in camouflage that we ever see. And it's interesting because these professional anglers, you know, they have a part-time job. They're like tradespeople, they are in construction, but they know where these animals are and what they do, right? They can't name the bones of the skull of the fish or understand the neurobiology, but boy, they can tell you exactly where the fish are. So they're very perceptive on something the scientists have no clue about. Name all these bones and everything and the systematics of the relationships of all these fish. But most of us can't go outside and say, hey, the fish is going to be here, it's going to be here, or it's going to eat at this time. So I'm fascinated by that. My story starts in the early 1970s. This is a picture of my mom and my dad as they on their wedding day. And what they did was they immigrated to New York from Taiwan, right, in search of a better life. They didn't speak English very well, so what they did was my dad was a busboy at a restaurant, you know, but it happened to be one day during lunchtime, he passed by a diner, and this is on the Lower East Side of New York City, I'm not sure exactly what street it was. He passed by a diner, it was for sale. $2,000. He's an impulsive man, so my dad spent all the savings and bought this diner. Right? This is the diner here. And the man who sold it to my dad said, oh, it's easy. You just pour coffee, 25 cents a cup. Just, you know, hand over fist. That's all you have to do is pour coffee. It was 25 cents back then. And the person who sold it to him, the man said, I'll train you, you know? I'll teach you how to make the coffee, how to cook, you know, short order cook, all that stuff. Well, guess what happened? My dad bought the diner. And the next day, the guy takes the money and runs. Right? My mom shows up. You know, they go the first day. They didn't know that, you know, the diner, you have to get there at like 4:30 in the morning. They show up, right? She's almost in tears. Customers start coming in. They start ordering eggs over easy. Sign up, right? My mom bursts in tears. She has no idea what to do. The Liao family lineage is doomed, right, at this point. And what happened next was that there were a few gentlemen that were retired, used to come to the diner quite a bit, and they said, why don't you hand me one of those aprons? And they took one of these aprons, and they got behind the counter, and they said, let me show you how to cook an egg sunny side up. So they taught my parents how to make every single dish. And after that, the restaurant kind of, you know, took off, or the diner kind of took off, and we made it through that rough patch. It's a busy life. So after that, they started the Chinese restaurant, then they started the first sushi restaurant in Scarsdale, New York. They've retired, you know, now 7 years ago, and they don't recommend the restaurant business. It's too busy. Occasionally, we have a Sunday off, and when we were little, my dad would take us to the East River, of all places, to go fishing. And so we'd catch these like little stunted eels and snapper bluefish and flounder. And so that's where I developed the love of natural history and fishes. This is kind of where I got this kind of all from. Here's a shot of me when we moved out to Westchester County. I fell in love with bass fishing, so I'd go to these golf ponds and college campuses and, you know, catch these bass, and I was so enamored with them that I would bring them home alive and put them in the bathtub. Like, I forbade anybody to take a shower for 3 days just to kind of watch them. And so somehow I channeled this energy into studying fish and kind of making a career out of it, really. This is a picture of me and my mom. I don't know, maybe I'm 8 or 9 years old. This is probably a bass that I took out of the bathtub a couple of minutes beforehand. And who would have thought that this passion could give rise to a moment which is a few minutes before I defend my PhD at Harvard. So here's my mom, she's drinking a Coke, which she never drinks, you know? And this literally was like 3 minutes before everyone filed in to hear me defend my PhD thesis. And this thesis was on essentially how fish swim. I discovered a new way fish swim. And it was really only because of all my observations in the field. So, because of that, I've lived a very privileged life of fishing, not in the East River, but here I'm fly fishing in New Zealand, right? And the thing to observe is that if you're an angler and you're in nature all the time, you know that water moves, right? And if you look underneath the surface, there are fish there. And here are two brown trout as they're jockeying for position behind this rock. And they prefer to be there. Right? Trout anglers know that behind certain rocks, fish are going to be holding station. And so I wanted to take some of this complexity that I observed in my off time when I'm angling and bring it into the lab to study how fish swim in really natural flows, which are kind of turbulent flows. And so I do this by using a phenomenon known as a Karman vortex street. So anytime you put a object in the water, such as a rock or a log or a cylinder, you'll see that there's a kind of an array of vortices, swirling eddies that are shed behind it. It's shed in a very organized way. And the nice thing about this von Karman vortex street is that you can see them anywhere. So they can be in the clouds on the lee side of Guadalupe Island, right? So anytime you have, you know, flow moving past what's called a bluff body, you're going to have this arrangement of vortices. You can describe this quite simply by something known as the wake wavelength, which is just this imaginary line that shows you the spacing between each of these vortices. The other thing you can do to describe it is something called the shedding frequency, which is just how fast these little packets, these little eddies, are peeling off these rocks or these cylinders. So I want to use this kind of phenomena to introduce to the fish a very controlled kind of turbulence, so to speak. here's our fish. This is Mr. Rainbow Trout, right? And here is the cylinder that I use to generate these vortices. This is in a float tank, so I can just dial up the speed, like kind of like a treadmill, and the fish swims away. If we look top down at a schematic, you see that when water flows past this kind of half cylinder, you have these eddies or vortices that are shed. Now let me explain the color. Red is counterclockwise flow. Blue is clockwise flow, counterclockwise flow. And so there's a region, because of the way these vortices are spinning, there's a region in between these vortices that's reduced in flow. So if I were to drop a stick here, it would still float downstream. It would just float downstream much more slowly than if you dropped a stick outside in what we call the free stream flow. For those of you that kayak, you'll know that there's also a region right behind the cylinder or rock where there's a region where water actually moves back upstream. Right? And so this is called a suction zone, and it's about 2 diameters downstream of this cylinder. So if you drop a stick here, it would actually move upstream and probably bounce around a little bit, and then it would probably get kicked out and follow one of these vortices as it drifts down. So this is the kind of a setup, the experiment. You can describe how fast these vortices are shedding by something known as the Struhal equation. Struhal number is a dimensionless number, which describes the oscillating phenomena of flows. And empirically, there's a value to it, 0.2, and it happens to be that value for a certain shape. Right? For cylinders, it happens to be 0.2. So Struhal number is equal to the diameter, this length term, diameter of the cylinder multiplied by the shedding frequency, how fast they're peeling off, f, all over the velocity. So basically, we know the Struhal number, we can put whatever size cylinder we want, we can crank up the flow speed however we want, we can predict what frequency these vortices are being shed. And if you know what the frequency is, and you also know what your flow speed is, can you control it, you can determine what the spacing or the wavelength is. So another way to put that is you have start out with a small cylinder. You introduce a very slow flow. You get a certain wavelength or spacing of the vortices, and you get a certain shedding frequency, twice a second about. If you keep that same cylinder in the flow tank, and all I do is I just crank up the flow speed, like a double the flow speed, this is what you see. Hopefully you can convince yourself that the wake wavelength, the spacing, is still the same. Just that the shedding frequency almost doubles. So it goes from 2 hertz to like 4 hertz. And so this is a way of trying to keep one thing the same, let's say it's a wake wavelength, right, and changing the shedding frequency. Now what happens if we keep the same kind of fast flow speed, these long arrows, right, and instead we swap out the small cylinder and we just put a cylinder that's twice the size. This is what we see. So the wavelength now is almost double that of the small cylinder situation. But the shedding frequency drops back down to the first scenario. This is just, you know, this is all to say we're trying to hold some things constant while changing the others to get a glimpse of what matters to the fish. Right? So we bombard the fish with different kind of hydrodynamic situations, and we ask the fish, what do you care about? You know, what works for you? So these are, I mean, the title could have been Conversations with Fish. But basically, my experiments are conversations with the fish, and depending on how I design the experiment, they can tell me something that I can interpret or not interpret.
Oh, wow.
So Jimmy, real quick.
No, that's okay.
I was going to ask you, the cylinder goes all the way through the flow.
Oh, perfect. Okay. Nice. So here's a schematic of our flow tank, right? Here's a cylinder. It goes up and down throughout the entire flow. We have a high-speed video camera looking up at it. And so the movies that I'm showing you down here, this is a trout while it's swimming. There's no cylinder in the water, right? And then the same trout, the same flow speed, all we did was just put a cylinder in there, and you see this behavior. And so one of the cool things about science is if you discover something, you can name it. I chose not to name it Jimmy Swimming because that's a little conceited. I called it the Karman Gate after Theodore von Karman, the famous fluid dynamicist. And so this really kind of flapping motion almost looks like a flag flapping in the wind, right? And so we became really interested in this, because the tailbeat frequency, when the fish is behind the cylinder, drops down considerably. It drops down to match that of the expected vortex shape frequency of the cylinder. So it looks like the fish is synchronizing somehow to the wake. So if you were a scientist, what would be the next question you'd want to ask?
Energy.
Energy, right. Okay. How much energy is it taking, right? Is this passive? Is it active? Is it kind of a hybrid between both things?
So I got a different question, Jimmy. So
yes.
In the no cylinder case, there's a fixed flow speed.
Yes.
What do you do to get the fish to behave? It looks like the fish is behaving nicely.
Fish psychology. The real answer is they like to kind of hold station. Sometimes they get squirrely and they kind of go all over the place, but you know, and each fish is kind of a little bit different. So if the fish is very sensitive to your presence, you can use that to your advantage. So if you walk towards it in the tank, it'll kind of move away a little bit. So if you want it back here, you kind of go around like this. You kind of do this, and then the. And then once it's in the right place, you kind of just leave it alone, and then it likes to be there. So I heard energy. One of the things that we wanted to do was we wanted to see these vortices in real time with the fish motion. So how do you visualize something that's transparent? How do you visualize water, right? Dye, right. So that's what we ended up doing. We took a sophisticated kind of version of dyes. We used something called digital particle image velocimetry. It's a technique that engineers have used for decades. They don't care about animals so much, but we do. So the way it works is we have two synchronized high-speed video cameras. One is aimed at a 45-degree mirror, so it views the image of the fish against particles shown that are lit up by a laser. So this green sheet here is a laser. Right, it's light. And we put particles in the water. They're minute particles. They almost look like clay, you know. And so this is what camera one sees. It's the silhouette of the fish against all these particles. Camera two is imaging a 45-degree mirror that's on top of this light sheet. So it's looking down at this light sheet. And this is what it sees. Right? Just an uninterrupted particle field, and you can notice that the fish here is just underneath this light sheet. So what can we do with this? We're trying to visualize the motions of the fish and the motions of the flow in real time. This is what it would look like, right? You have the fish as it's carmingating, sashaying back and forth. Here's all the particles going by. If we do some kind of software analysis on the flow, we can better visualize these swirling patterns, right? So the next slide that I'm going to show you is a movie of the same, essentially the same video, but what we've done is color-coded the swirling motions. So that's what it looks like. Again, I'll remind you that blue is clockwise flow. So you see these blue vortices coming down. Red is counterclockwise. So you see it goes blue, then red, then blue, then red. Right? And mapped on top of that are the arrows showing kind of the flow. Yes, question.
In the middle of this situation, what if you scare the fish and they have to take off very quickly?
Nice.
Do they get caught in the vortices or do they make a straight path?
We haven't scared the fish, but what we have done is we've fed the fish. And so we'll put like a little trout pellet, you know, a food pellet here, and they'll come out voluntarily and grab it. And they'll head back in. Right, so they're not stuck there. They like to come out and grab it. And as a fly fisherman, I'm thinking, okay, how can I use this to make it? But yeah, we haven't tried that. We haven't tried that. That would be a very interesting experiment to do. What I want to point out here is that the fish is slaloming between these vortices. Right. So the alternative is it could drive its head into the center of each vortex. It's actually slaloming around. And you see these arrows, those are the velocity vectors. So when the arrows tip up, the fish moves up. When the arrows tip down, the fish moves down. So it's really kind of going with the flow, right? This is the prelude to the Taoism. I showed my dad a video of this, and he immediately said, oh, that's just like Wu Wei. Okay, I was like, okay, so what's Wu Wei? He's like, oh, it's a Taoist philosophy that means, you know, to do nothing and everything gets done. Right. Effortless action. Grad students are trying to project that in my lab. But it's this idea of harnessing the energy of the environment to do your bidding. So this is really interesting philosophy. whereby, and these are the Chinese characters for Wu Wei, whereby obstacles in your life you can use to propel yourself forward. Without these obstacles, without this turbulence, you have to do all the hard work of swim through steady water or still water. But if you have this turbulence, you can use it. You can use it to move forward. And if you're interested, I wrote a piece, this is years ago now, and NPR is this, I believe, on this kind of idea of turbulence and how it's actually can be a benefit in one's life.
It's like a keto.
Yeah, it is. Right. Energy recapture. Animals can actually recapture energy from their environment to save them energy.
Question.
Yeah?
So it looks like the fish shape is actually being used as a wing.
Yeah, that's a great observation. How many of you in this room sail?
Wing.
Oh.
Sailors?
Yeah.
So the terminology of tacking, yeah, which is being able to move upwind, you know, you have to go really far to one side and just a little bit upwind, but then you switch it and then you go really far to one side and just a little bit upwind. I think what's happening here with the fish's body is it's a sail, but it's also a rudder. So this is why it's important that you're flexible like a fish, because you're both sail and rudder at the same time. If you're a stiff, you know, stick or something, or I've tried to put fishing lures in there that are stiff, then they can't do this behavior at all, because you need to be the right amount of flexibility. So, sail and rudder, yeah.
It seems like, the vortex is stable within the flow. So it looks like it's pushing against the vortex, the relative stability of the vortex. Is that
it's, you want it pushing or getting sucked into one, you know, I'm not really sure, but yeah, it's definitely being kind of moved side to side between these low pressure boards.
Yeah, I'm trying to stare at this line of looking at your flow vectors and so on. Does the fish appear to anticipate the vortex or react to it?
That's a great question. Does it anticipate it? I don't think so. I don't think so, and I'll try to. I don't think it's doing that. We haven't done the experiment, but we can come up with a way to, instead of generating red, blue vortices, we can do red, blue, red, you know, and kind of have them miss one. And I doubt that the fish would actually go to a place that it's anticipating. I really think it's reacting off of what the water's doing. So whatever the water's doing, the fish is doing, with a certain amount of control. So it's not totally passive. That's a great observation. We had a question over here.
So is it a coincidence that you can't see it so well in this video, but that the shape of the vortices is very close to the shape of the fish?
The shape of the vortices? Oh, I see. It's like circular, but...
Well, if you back up two or three slides, the shape of your vortices is fish-shaped.
Oh, I see. Ooh, that's interesting. I never really quite thought about it that way. I'm not sure if it makes... I'm not sure if it makes a huge amount of difference. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but I don't know if you could
adapt
to it. I think we haven't played around with changing the morphology of the vortices. Usually when they shed, they're going to shed pretty circularly, right? But I guess there's ways that we could try to make elongate vortices and see if that, you know, if the fish like that more or less. I would try to approach that experimentally. Another question in the back.
So is the ability to do this related to the lateral lines?
Oh, tough question. We think so. I'll show you a couple experiments later on where we were looking at the lateral line sense. Yeah.
We've studied sharks. We know about their bioelectric sensors, etc. Do you know the sensors on the fish that actually senses the turbulence? Is it pressure on the skin? Is it what kinds of things biologically?
Yeah. So there's a system called the lateral line system, which is composed of hair cells, very similar to the ones in your inner ear. Fish also have an inner ear, but they have this unique kind of sensory system where the hairs are distributed up and down the body and the head, right? And they're sensitive to water velocity as well as water acceleration. And I'll show you a kind of an image of that later on, where these sensors are actually placed. But yeah, they detect two things in the water, velocity and acceleration. There's a kind of a sweet spot here where the fish is staying. If it's too close, it gets caught in that suction region, hits its head on the cylinder. So beginning fish will do this. You put them in there, they bonk their head twice, and then they realize, okay, I'm going to hang back here. And they don't want to be too far back because then the energy the vortices dissipates and they end up swimming again, right? And so this is essentially surfing fish. Fish are learning how to surf.
If the fish were not expending any energy, even though the vortices were there,
yes,
would it drift backwards or drift with the flow? Is it expending energy or is the vortex pushing it to the left?
Yeah. I would say that it is not spending much energy at all, but enough to stay in this region. I'm going to show you a movie later on that will show you how little energy it actually takes.
So do they have a slipstream, like you see with trucks or bicycles?
Yeah, so like bicycles, you know, the Tour de France, you know, they're all drafting.
So that's what they're doing?
They're doing that, but plus another thing. So they're drafting in the sense that if you measure the average velocity here, it's slower than if you measure it out here. So of course, why not just be behind the rock where you're shielded from the fast flow? But it's actually doing another thing, which is it's harnessing the energy of the vortices, right? And so we're able to kind of tell that experimentally, but it's kind of a two-for-one kind of thing. It's not only enjoying this slower flow, but it's got these energy packets, these low-pressure vortices that are coming, that are pulling it side to side, that are working on the flexible body that's making it both sail and rudder.
Yeah. Jimmy,
well,
you
want to
go to another slide?
Okay. It's a doozy, yeah, it's a doozy. Okay.
The end.
Okay. I want to know how you know he's enjoying it.
I know he's enjoying it because when you feed it, it'll go back. It goes back. And then if you chase it away, it'll go back. It's kind of like a trout in its home rock. Right? It likes to be there.
It seems similar to the space shots where they go around the planets in order to pick up space. I wonder if they are able to...
Nice. I bring it back to astrophysics. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, the gravitational pull of the vortices is bringing planet Earth / fish to... Yeah, it could be. A smarter person would have to kind of, you know, figure that out for me. Okay, so moving on. So is it passive or active? This is where fish acupuncture comes into play. So you have this fish that has these serial blocks of muscles. You know, if you fillet a fish or you eat grilled salmon tomorrow night. And what the fish does is it contracts these muscles in order to swim. And what we can do is we can put fine wire electrodes into the muscle of the fish. So these hypodermic needles are smaller than acupuncture needles. And you can actually put them just into the superficial muscle just underneath the skin. And all these wires come out here, and we amplify these minute signals, and we can tell when the muscle is active along the body. Right? And so we put them in various locations just to see if this is an active process. Are they contracting muscles, or is this just totally passive? And so these four insertion sites I'm going to show in the next slide, over here. These are the four insertion slides. Here's the fish swimming without a cylinder. And what I'm showing you here is a sequential wave of muscle activity. So this is time here on the x-axis. And you can see that the muscles at the head contract first. And a little bit later, the muscles down here contract. And a little bit later, these contract. And at the very end, this contracts. And so this is what causes the body of the fish to bend into a wave, right? This wave. This pushes on the body, on the water, and moves the fish forward. This is how fish swim in steady flow or in still water. Here's the same fish over here. Same flow speed. All we've done is we've put a cylinder in front of it. So again, you see this kind of really dramatic side-to-side flapping motion. But what's really cool is that half the body from here down is totally passive. It's totally passive, right? The only muscle activity, and this isn't even all the time, I'm just showing you an example. Only muscle activity is the muscle that's near the head. So I think their muscles are contracting to steer into a vortex or away from a vortex. So you're steering, and then you're letting the rest of the body kind of do its thing, so to speak. It's totally passive.
Does the active muscle ever move down, or is it always
the... It's usually always at the head. Usually always at the head. I should mention that sometimes we'll see no muscle activity at all. None. But what the animal's doing is it's flicking out its fins. Right? has all these control surfaces, its fins. So it just flicks out a fin, just the way you might kind of reverse a stroke on a canoe, and it'll just turn. So you'll see no muscle activity, but the fins will be active back and forth.
And it still gets forward motion without the propulsion from the tail.
Yeah, it can still, you know, it's holding station, so it's not drifting back, but the water is moving past it. Yeah, that's right. And so why do the fish do this? Because it saves energy. So I showed you it uses less muscle activity, but the real kind of gold standard is to measure how much oxygen the animal uses. It's like putting, you know, your brother on a treadmill and putting an oxygen mask on and exercise, saying, how costly is this? So we do that in a fish, but you can't put a mask on a fish. What you do is you buy a $70,000 tank, you know, that you can seal off the lid, and you can measure the oxygen that's being used by this little fish as it's swimming. And you can do it when it's swimming in the free stream, no cylinder situation, and then you can do it when it's behind the cylinder. Same fish, right? And so you can really understand, what does it cost to do this behavior? These are these conversations with fish that I have. So here's the flow velocity. This is how fast we dial up the flow speed here on the x-axis. And the y is some measurement of how much oxygen the animal uses, normalized to its body weight. And you can see that for a fish that is just swimming in the free stream flow, no cylinder, the cost, the amount of oxygen that you use, goes up, right, with the flow speed. That makes sense. The faster you have to swim, the more oxygen you have to use. But now the same fish, same flow speed, now with the cylinder in front of it, this curve is now shifted, right? And so it's actually, for the same flow speed, it's using much less oxygen than it would if it didn't have the cylinder.
Jimmy, is the offset at zero velocity just a metabolic rate to keep the fish alive?
Yeah, that's what it is. And so this satisfies the scientific reviewers. They want to know, and so we give them this. But we knew anecdotally years before we bought this expensive tank, because what happens is we turn on the flow speed, it's really fast, this trout is swimming, and 5 minutes later it's pooped. It's back against the back baffle, we turn off the water, we let it recover. If you just put a cylinder in that flow tank, instead of lasting for 5 minutes, it could last for 5 hours. You sit there, you go to lunch, it's still doing the same thing. So we knew that it was using less energy. This is the world I live in. We have to prove it, we have to spend a lot of money, all that stuff. So, if you don't believe me, this is a dead fish towed behind the cylinder, right? This is on a 14-pound test, fluorocarbon, for those of you that care. What's interesting is that, so this movie is looped over and over, but I want to point out that at a certain point of this cycle, the fish, the dead fish, synchronizes with the vortex tree just right, that actually moves upstream. So it's coming out, because I've seen this video a zillion times. Here it is. Gets caught in suction zone, hits its head against the cylinder, flops back down, starts the cycle over again.
You're not moving the string. You're not moving the line.
I'm moving the line. It's not a stretchy line. And so what you're seeing here is that in a totally passive object, you're generating thrust passively to move upstream. Amazing. Just by the intrinsic flexibility of the musculoskeletal system. Forget about the nervous system. Forget about the brain. Just the body properties in and of itself. And trust me, I tried to use like different plastic, you know, fish that we molded to do it, lures, wouldn't do it. Even a fish that you froze and then thawed won't even do this, right? It has to be a freshly euthanized fish that still has mucus on it, doesn't have rigor mortis at all. But if you do that, you see this pattern. So it's interesting because energy recapture is not anything new. Windmills do it, turbines do it all the time, right? But they generate drag. This is in an oscillating flow. You can get a phenomenon where you can generate thrust. You can propel yourself without any net power input.
Boeing will be interested in this.
It turns out that whalers knew about this hundreds of years ago. So I came across some literature. Yeah, you have a question.
In this video, the flow is to the right.
Yeah, left to right.
The von Karman vortexes are above and below.
Yeah.
And they are rotating such that when you kind of stay between them, the direction of the flow of the vortex ring is opposite the main flow.
Yeah, that's right.
What is a net resultant flow velocity near that boundary? Is it going to the left or to the right?
Oh, I see. So in this region here,
yeah,
it's going to the right. It's still net downstream. It's still net downstream. Closer to the cylinder in that suction region, it is going to the left. Yeah.
Is there something about the sail feature of the fish that lets it do that in spite of the downstream net flow?
Yeah, I would say that the lateral profile of the fish, so when I show you the side view, the fish is fish-shaped, right? But if you have, some fishes are very deeply compressed, like a bluegill sunfish or a pompano or a permit or something. If you have more flag area this way, you can harness the energy of these vortices much easier.
Trout don't have scales.
Trout don't have any scales, yeah. They can still do this fairly well, but I can imagine something like a smallmouth bass or bluegill sunfish could probably do even better because they have a kind of a bigger body area.
Can you expand a little on the whaling reference?
Yeah, that's right, the whaling reference. So whalers knew this like 100 years ago because it turns out if you harpoon a whale, and if you just leave it, it'll float off like at 1 nautical mile faster than if you cut its flukes off. So they would harpoon a whale and they would cut its flukes off because if you didn't, the tail, right, the flukes, would interact with the surface waves, this oscillatory flow, and kind of drift away. Similar phenomenon. Gruesome, but similar phenomenon. Okay, so when I fly fish, at least, I don't see dead fish swimming upstream all the time, right? So there's got to be some active component to it. And that became the focus of our research, right? But they do more complex things than just save energy. So does anybody know what this little critter up here is?
Helgramite?
Not a helgramite, but it is living in with helgramites. It's a mayfly larva. Yeah. And so if you kind of study the currents behind objects and you tie your flies just right to mimic this, you might have the glorious experience of trying to come into contact with wild rainbow trout. This happens to be in New Zealand. So to me, it's all about kind of connection. So if you can kind of gain insight into these animals, you can, for a brief moment, you know, just come into contact with something that always exists out there, exists way before us, exists after us, and just something very satisfying about being part of that process. And that's something I get being out in the field all the time. And just knowing more on the scientific side just kind of increases my appreciation. Now, I actually don't want people necessarily just catch more fish. I want them to appreciate what they are doing out there. And so I mentioned that these fish like to be here, and you can drop pellets of food. So keep your eye on that little pellet as I play this movie. You'll see that the fish is not just carmagating, but it'll dart out and kind of grab this little pellet of food. Right. So we're very interested in how they're doing this. You know, what's the kind of control strategy of how you intercept something that's kind of squiggling around a lot, right? And for those fly anglers out there, you know, you can be thinking about how you drift your fly, you know, and how close it has to get to that rock, right, for the fish to come out and grab it. Obviously, if you put a fly way out here, probably not going to come out and grab it. But if you get it just where it lies, and whether you see a foam line or whatnot, that's when the fish will commit and try to grab it. It won't go too far. It doesn't want to come out here because you got to swim. And why swim when you can surf? But the thing is, I think what anglers do is they see a rock and they just kind of haphazardly kind of cast around it, you know. Very precise. You have to be very precise, you know, with it. And if you can't be very precise, I would cast to it like 10 times, you know, because not only is your fly drifting, your line's drifting, which is pulling on the fly and all this other stuff. So it made me really appreciate exactly how precise these animals are, because if you're here, you're saving 50% of your energy. If you're a couple centimeters, couple inches over, you're not. Right? Very specific. Okay, so here's some graphs showing you how much energy it costs to feed while they're behind the cylinder. So this is the number of attacks per hour. So what I would do is I would tie these hookless flies that look like trout pellets, because we want to do repeated measures. So I would drift these artificial flies past the fish, and we get them to come out and grab it, you know, and let it go, and grab it, and let it go. And the whole time we're doing that, we're measuring how much oxygen they're using, right? We're putting the mask on the fish as we're doing this. And you'll see that when the fish is in the free stream or no cylinder flow, you know, as you increase your number of tacks, you know, the more effort you have, the more kind of oxygen you have to use. It's not too surprising. But then if you have the fish saving energy behind the cylinder, but coming out across the vortex street to grab food, that's actually really costly. It's really costly. So it'd be great if the food just came right in front of it in the vortex street. But if it's outside and the fish has to go across that vortex street, it's actually really costly. Right? And so here's another graph showing you flow velocity again on the x-axis. And this is prey capture success. So this is if the trout darts out and tries to grab the food, what percentage of the time is it successful? And you can see that as the flow velocity increases, the success goes down if you're in the no cylinder situation. But the success goes down even more if you're behind the cylinder, right? And so this makes a bit of sense because, you know, you have this particle that's kind of squealing around and you're also kind of going back and forth, and so the chance of actually successfully grabbing that pellet or fly is actually lower. So a little bit counterintuitive, but when you're feeding in this vortex street, it's actually more costly and it's actually less successful, right? And so you came up with a model kind of trying to show at low speeds, it's better to refuge and not feed. And then when there's a lot of food, you should go out to the free stream and just gobble a lot of food when you can. And trout anglers know this because when's the best time to fish for trout is during a hatch, right? And so the trout aren't behind their little rocks. When there's a hatch, they're all over the stream, you know, and they're feeding, and they're feeding, and they're feeding. So someone asked about the lateral line system. Here's the dead fish here. I'm going to show you a movie of a trout. This is shot in infrared light, so this is in the dark, right? We have a camera that picks up this image even though it's in the dark. We do this so the fish doesn't see anything visually. Here's a syringe. I'm going to play this movie. This stopper is going to depress, shoot a transparent jet of water, and you'll see what this lateral line does. So here we go. We're going to depress the plunger right about now. Senses the flow in the absence of any visual cues, right? Squirt it and it'll just take off. So it's sensing flow along the body. And so we're interested in whether or not they're using this in order to kind of surf on these vortices. And so this is the distribution of these hair cell sensors up and down the body of the fish. This is taken from the anatomical literature. They have three lines along the head and then one line down the body. Now, it's really hard to make these recordings and have the fish move. So unlike the muscle recordings, where it's a thin wire, these wires are actually quite thick. And so we can't put them on the fish. So we have to think of a creative way to figure out how the fish is sensing the water. We decided to do this by scanning one of our preserved trout, 3D scan it. Then we can 3D print it with all the holes where these sensors are. And then we can put our sensors, pressure sensors, these are surgical pressure sensors that people put in people's veins and arteries and things like that. We put them on the model fish head. And why would we do that? Well, the reason is we'd put these sensors along here. All these sensors come out, you know, and are kind of wired in. We want to understand what information, what hydrodynamic flow information is available to a fish-shaped head. We can't put it on a live fish, so the second best thing is we hijack the shape of the fish, put our sensors in it, and say, okay, what can you feel? We do this in a static situation where the head's not moving at all. We can get a lot of great information from that. But what we really want to do is understand what the flow is like when the animal's moving. Right? And so for that, we have to turn to kind of a engineered system where we have a contraption that basically heaves the model back and forth as well as yaw. So the heave is side-to-side motion, and yaw is kind of like twisting a straw, kind of rotating it around. And we have this machine that can do these two things independently of each other. There's also a force transducer attached to the strut that's holding these models. And this force transducer allows us to measure whether or not this motion that we impart on this fish is generating thrust, or is it generating drag going backwards. So we can evaluate the result of the motions that we program into this soft robot. These are just pictures showing you the mold where we have these flexible bodies, and here are the different physical models that we use. So this is an example of a video of what we do. We have our 3D printed flexible fish body. We put it on this kind of robotic arm, and it's heaving and twisting the fish in a way that is very similar to a live fish. What's important about this system is that you can swim a fish in a way that a live fish doesn't want to swim. And so we can evaluate, because we have the force transducer up here, if we swim a fish in a way that a fish doesn't usually swim, is it because it generates a lot of drag? Or is that actually a better way to move forward? And fish, for some reason, haven't discovered this. Right? Questions we can ask. Right? Very powerful. So, I'm going to show you some data where we've actually put a pressure transducer on the head of the fish, right? And I'm going to show you what kind of information is available to this robotic fish as we're doing this experiment. So here's a color-coded plot here. I'm going to walk you through it. On the x-axis is the frequency in which we heave the fish back and forth. So we do it 1 hertz, once a second, or 2 hertz, twice a second. This is just heaving it back and forth. On the y-axis is something that's describing the phase difference between the heave and the yaw, the twist. So what this means is, at zero, for instance, we push the fish to one side, and at the very end, we twist it, right? At 180, we push the fish, heave it to one side, and halfway through, we twist it, right? And then continue heaving it. And then up here, we twist it first, and then we just heave it all the way, right? And the reason why there's color on here is because, remember, we had this force transducer, and it's measuring how much force is being produced by this motion. So where you have a hot color, red, that means that this combination of motions causes the model to move upstream, right? And where it's cool, where it's blue, all this space out here means that that motion means that the fish is generating a lot of drag. It wants to go downstream. And then in green just means that it's breaking even, it's holding station, it's not wanting to go forward or back. So let me show you a couple movies to make this a little more intuitive. I'm selecting certain regions of phase relationships. So these are different motions, right? I'm selecting a blue one with drag, a red one for thrust, and one that's kind of greenish. And these are the movies of the motions that are corresponding to it. So that first one on the bottom where you see it's blue, and so it's very draggy, that's the motion that we impart. So probably not surprising that that would produce a lot of drag. It doesn't really look like a real fish swim. The second one up is red, so this does produce thrust. And you can see it looks kind of fish-like, right? There's a propagating sine wave that moves from head to tail. And then the top one is kind of bluish-green, so it's kind of breaking even, and that's what that looks like. It's kind of like a standing wave, like it's bending into a C and then reversing the sea, and it's reversing. So what's interesting is when you put a pressure sensor on these fish, these model fish, and you look at the information that you can recover, this is what you see. So this is, time is one tail beat cycle, when the tail moves from left to right, back to left. And this is pressure. I'm showing this kind of schematically. And what I want you to concentrate on is that these pressure profiles across one tail beat cycle are very different from each other. So we can't say that the fish is really using this, but we can at least say, in theory, the fish could use these unique pressure profiles along the head to determine if they're generating thrust or drag. So I'm going to summarize and just say we've kind of walked through some adventures of fish, how and why kind of fish swim in unsteady flows, which is, I think, is the natural condition for fishes, especially in streams. And we talked about this new carmingating technique, like carmingate, I guess, to emphasize how important it is. And it depends on their feeding behavior a bit. So it can actually be quite costly if they're actually trying to feed in that carmingate. And what is the role of the lateral line system? And I've showed you just in these past few slides that the lateral line recognizes optimal swimming. Again, in theory, right? We can't really do it on the live fish yet. We have to wait for technology to catch up. But the question I get asked a lot when I give this talk is, well, Jimmy, how does this make me catch more fish? I'm not even the science, but at the end of the day, it's like, how can I catch more fish? And I've got a very simple answer, which is to fish more often. Thank you very much.
You've talked about the importance of the lateral line. Different species have different sensors. I take a striper, for example.
Yeah.
Have you tried different species in your tank to see if any of this changes?
Yeah, we saw probably about 60 species so far. I work at a marine lab, the Whitney Lab for Marine Bioscience at the University of Florida. We're literally 50 yards from the ocean. So last year, we had a paper come out in PNAS, which looked at the performance of basically any fish we could get our hands on. So we swim sharks, we swim freshwater fish, we swim schooling fish, and they all can carmingate. They can all do this behavior. We haven't measured the oxygen consumption of all of them because it takes quite a bit, but just the kinematics, the motions are very similar. I would say the two exceptions that we've seen are eels, where if an eel gets sucked into the suction zone, it'll wrap its body around the cylinder, and it'll just stay put, so they can't really get anything else. And the other one is sharks. So if you put a shark in the vortex tree, it turns out that carmingating is more about producing drag, putting on the brakes at the right time, than it is about generating thrust. So the field of fish locomotion is always obsessed with how much thrust you get, how efficiently a fish can swim. With the carmingate, it's putting up enough drag with your fins in your body to stay back and not in that suction zone. Sharks don't have that control of their pectoral fins the way ray fin fishes do. And so you'll see the shark getting sucked up and it's trying to put on its brakes and it just hits the cylinder every time. So sharks, if you wanted to make like a shark thing to repel sharks, yeah, you might want to generate some turbulent flow because they probably wouldn't like that very much. Yeah, question?
Oh, was the cover of the Science magazine your...
I peeked early. That was my PhD after that. Someone did a calculation. It's like a 1 in 1 million to get a cover shot. So I spent 2 days with the camera, the best 2 days I spent on my life. Yeah, question.
Have you applied any of these dynamics to a fishbowl?
To a fish?
Or a school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it turns out that hydrodynamically, the flow behind the cylinder, the vortex tree, is fairly similar to two fish swimming side by side in a school.
Huh.
So the next project we want to do is have our robotic fish in there and put live fish and see if they'll actually position themselves in the school.
Huh. Yeah. So if you just turn everything 90 degrees, does this describe flat fish undulating?
Yep. Like that's wonderful. We haven't done it, but that's true. The axis of the vortices spinning has to match up with the direction that the fish wants to undulate. So if you took the cylinder and you rotated it like this and you took a trout, it probably wouldn't be able to capture the energy of the vortices very well. But if you had like a flat fish or flounder, then you could do this, or maybe a dolphin, if you go to marine mammals.
So Jim, one thing, some fish need to use their fins to generate lift.
Which
means they need a high relative velocity.
Right.
So these fish have swim bladders, they don't need to generate lift? Or?
No, yeah. I mean, I would say certain sharks need to generate some amount of lift.
So what about tunas?
Tunas? We haven't been able to get tunas. We've done some high performance fishes like jacks and kind of some small mackerel, but we haven't had a tuna in the lab yet. But that would be very interesting to see.
Because they really need the relative velocity so they don't
do, yeah. Tuna are horrible at maneuvering, so I imagine they wouldn't do very good. Yeah, that's the reason why you don't see tuna like right on the coral reefs. Yeah.
Great. Oh, one more.
Just one more. Yeah. Does this have, if I think of drafting behind a truck, you know, on a bike or in a sports car, it's some of that is relevant, but it's a different medium, different viscosity. How does any of this translate over in a way that might be relevant to thinking about energy conservation for vehicles?
Yeah, for vehicles? Potentially. My approach would be to kind of look at the morphology of that, you know, truck or whatever ahead, and there might be an attached vortex, kind of like that suction zone, and you might be able to play around with the shape and the size of that. And I'll show you kind of this last, you know, that slide up here that I didn't talk about, but you'll see this movie right here. So this is all the same fish. Here's the cylinder. This is the carongate we're talking about. This is way ahead, so it's free stream. This is what's doing another behavior I totally didn't talk about, but it's called entraining, and this is more similar to drafting, what you're saying. So the cylinder is the truck. Here's the suction zone. You can have your body act as an airfoil, not undulate at all, balance between thrust and drag, and basically hang out. This is the amplitude envelope, the midlines of the fish over one tailbeat cycle. You see it's very skinny compared to the carongate. Right? And so you can balance yourself right behind the cylinder. So
it sounds like fishing advice.
It does, yeah. So there's various places you can kind of be. I mean, right now, if you can believe it, they gave me a PhD from Harvard to put a stick in the water, right? But if you do that, you can see there's already four behaviors going on. What happens if you put three sticks? You know, what happens if you put a log jam? What happens if you 3D print a coral, you know, staghorn coral and see what's going on? So I think there's a really rich field when you mix something as complex as hydrodynamics and behavior together. Job security.
I've always thought of streams as being pretty complex, but I'm looking at, yeah, but in a sense it's static because it's the flow is like this for a period of time, and so the fish are finding these places. What happens in the ocean and the surf? What are some of the, I mean, these fish are dealing with flows that are constantly changing.
Right. That was my plan when I moved to the marine lab, was we were going to look at fish in the surf zone, because those of you that fish in the surf know that you don't want to cast way out there. You want to cast where the waves are breaking, because it kind of digs into the sand, all these invertebrates come up. And so I know the fish are hanging out in that surf zone. How they could interact with that wave energy would be very interesting. We'd like to build a wave machine and put some of that.
What kind of behavior did a truck have put that? And have it at night, what does it do?
Oh, at night. Honestly, when I've snorkeled at night, a lot of trout will be under a rock.
Oh, under a rock.
Yeah, they'll be under rocks. A lot of times they'll be in training behind there as well. Sometimes they'll be kind of carmageddon, but they'll find regions where they don't have to pay attention to as much. So we've done experiments where the fish are carmageddon, where we shut down the lights, and it turns out they still will carmageddon, but they won't do it as much as when there's light. It's almost like they visually want to lock onto something. And when it's dark, they'll do it, but they won't stay there for hours the way you see, you know, during the daytime.
You're putting together with the physics of flocking person, because somehow or other this is an individual thing, but in groups, they like you mentioned, they may behave differently.
One of the student projects we're doing at QBio is to put multiple fish behind the cylinder. I haven't shown you the videos yet, but it's pretty interesting. You know, they're territorial, so they'll chase each other out, and there's kind of.
You'll find people react the same way, probably.
Yeah, probably.
All right. On that note, thank you.